Good afternoon. So last time we introduced speculative execution, sort of this idea that we speculate, we guess about what instructions we should run and just start running them. And of course, since we're guessing, we're speculating, we're not sure. And it turns out that that's a problem we can deal with by fixing things up later on when we realize that our guess wasn't correct. So the main way we saw this being used was with what we called branch prediction, where we're taking conditional jumps. Apparently I have interesting. Okay. Conditional jumps and deciding which way the jump will go. So conditional jump, like jump is less than, we'll guess whether it's less than or not, and just run code immediately based on it. We learned we could do a little better than that. So we had sort of branch prediction strategies where we didn't just like always guess the same thing, but we looked at some context. One form of context was we could look at the actual code and say, where is this jump going? What sort of code's around it, and these we call static strategies. So they aren't based on what actually sort of we've seen happen. They're just based on looking at code. And with static branch prediction, we learn there's this pretty simple strategy of just looking, does the branch go earlier or later, and predicting based on what would happen if this was part of a loop. And then we learn that, well, we can do better than that with strategies which are based on history, that we make this assumption that usually a conditional jump or something like that will work the same way over and over again. And this works if we assume loops again, because most loops sort of have these repeating patterns, and we can use that to make predictions. But to do those sort of history-based predictions, we need to store the history somehow. And well, we're gonna kind of like look at our idea of caches and apply that in this scenario. We're gonna have something kind of like a cache, but instead of storing data for us, it's gonna store recent outcomes of conditional jumps. And we'll look up what happened before in that. And it's a cache, and as a cache, like it's not always gonna have our values, even if they were there before because it has limited capacity, but that's okay. Because if we guess wrong, we know how to deal with that. So then, we said, okay, that's nice, but we like to do better than we can do in our pipeline processor. Branch prediction and forwarding meant that we almost never had to not fetch an instruction each cycle. But there were some cases where we couldn't do that because we had one instruction that was slow and everything was waiting behind it. And also, like, one instruction a cycle is going to limit us. And modern processors avoid both of these problems. So they're multiple issue. They run multiple instructions at once. We'll see that we use the term issuing for starting instructions, basically. And they're out of order. That if we have one instruction that's slow, we don't just stop running instructions until we finish that one. We just go on to some other instructions that we can run right away. And we saw kind of a example design that we're going to sort of use as our reference for how these processors could work, where we had this kind of in-order beginning of the processor, where we fetched instructions kind of the same way we did in our pipeline processor, except we usually fetch more than one at a time, and did some pre-processing of those instructions. We saw an example with registry naming as a form of pre-processing. And then we have this part in the middle of the processor, which is actually out of order, where we're not going to run instructions in the order they appeared in the sort of assembly, the way we kind of simulate the assembly by hand, which is what our pipeline processor was doing as far as the order, like we actually like did the execute step in, for example. Instead, we're going to run them in whatever order makes sense given what values are ready. And we'll look at a way you can make that process work later today. And we mentioned there's this some last step. We're not going to go into details of all the bookkeeping needed to do this, but we need to do some bookkeeping to finish up instructions. This is also kind of necessary to, you know, figure out when to free up registers, because we learn with register renaming, we're using all these extra registers, and also to deal with recovering from a branch misprediction. So we'll have some bookkeeping for that, and we'll have some stuff that runs to finish up instructions that will run in order, that will do one instruction, then the next, rather than doing it as values are available. And that's just for the bookkeeping for things like freeing up registers. And we looked into, first, something that happens in the in-order fetch stage, which was register naming. We mentioned we wanted to do sort of this hazard detection, that we wanted to like figure out, you know, whether we have a hazard, whether we have some value we want that's not available yet. And we wanted to do it for this out-of-order processor, and we could use the same kind of techniques we use in our pipeline processor, but a lot of scenarios get very complicated because we're running things out of order. And also, it turns out we often might need to store like two different versions of a register's value somewhere while we're waiting for instructions to use those. So we had a sort of solution that both solved this problem of how do we store all the different versions of values we might be needing, and also are going to help us do that, figuring out of what instructions depend on what other instructions in an efficient way. And this idea was register naming. And sort of the key insight is that each version of a register gets its own name. And because we give a new name to each version of a register, in this scheme, after we do this renaming step, every register is written exactly once. We're going to really take advantage of that when we talk about how we run instructions in this scheme. So questions about things we covered last time? Yes? Can I go over what I mean by every register is written exactly once in register renaming? Sure. So when we did our register renaming example, we like chose new physical registers each time we did a write. And that means that when I looked at the rename instructions here, I know X20 is written by the subtract instruction and absolutely nothing else. And we're going to use that later to say, if something needs that value from the subtract instruction, I'm going to just look for, has X20 been written? I'm not going to need to track that subtract instruction explicitly. I'm just going to track X20. Whereas if we were using the unrenamed version, you know, that idea wouldn't work, because I would need to look at R11, and well, R11 is written a bunch of times, and I can't as easily tell, you know, has R11 written. I need to separately track what instruction it came from, which was doable, but this is kind of a nice scheme for doing that. It was what register renaming can be viewed as, and what we're going to use it for. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, and we finished up with register renaming last time. And I mentioned we have one problem of dealing with memory. We're not going to go into the details of that. I've kind of represented it as we're remembering that these instructions deal with memory, and we have to actually have logic to figure out, oh, are we writing to a memory location that's the same as the one we're reading? Because if so, we need to make sure we do the write before the read. And there's some way that my processors do that. And we're not going to talk about what the actual mechanism used, because it's actually very complicated, because modern processors have decided it's really important for performance to try to do that read really early, even if we can't write the value yet, or even compute where the value goes. So they do something kind of like branch prediction for it. So, you know, the basic mechanism is the same as branch prediction. We're not going to talk about the details of how it works, because obviously there's a lot of bookkeeping and how do you do the undoing of instructions that we're going to kind of just say it happens. We don't really care about how it happens. Yeah. Was there any plan of doing quiz questions? Nope. I can answer questions about them, but I did. I have slides prepared, but I was not planning on going over them. I will answer questions about them if you have them, but I'm not going to just do it unsolicited. Okay, so, yeah.
Very quick question. Number one on the quiz, it says basically depending if you stall after the last register.
So, the question is that you say it depends depending if you stall after the last register. So, I think a more realistic way that this pipeline would work is that we'd take something that was like this, and where we already have a PC register, and we turn it into something like this, where we had sort of 8 pieces. So we'd end up adding 7 pipeline registers. So I think that's the better answer, is that we'd add 7 pipeline registers, and therefore we'd have to somehow account for 7 pipeline register delays. And each clock cycle would be the sort of use, you can kind of think of as half of a register, some logic, and half of a register's time. So it'd be some that part of that logic plus a pipeline register delay.
So is the reason 1140 is the more correct answer is because you're not including the first register that's already there?
Is the reason 1140 is the more correct answer because I'm not including the first register that should already be there? Yeah. So I assume we don't add a new register for pipelining to the beginning. We have one, which is the program counter, but we had that anyways. That's not a pipeline register per se, it's just part of how the processor, worked before. Okay. Other questions? Okay. As I said, sorry, it didn't look to me like there's anything I urgently needed to go over on the quiz, and I'd like to get through some stuff. So let's do some practice doing register renaming, which if you've looked at the OOO homework, it would be useful to know how to do. So I'm going to go through here. So our first instruction, we're going to follow the convention that when we do the renaming, we want to have a different name for the sources and the destination. So I'm going to rework these into 3 operand instructions for that reason. And I'm going to say, we want R8. R8 is X13. I want R9, which is X17. And I always choose a new name for my destination register. So I'm going to take that for my list of free registers here. And that's going to be a new name for R9. Some questions on what I did there? Yeah?
Did we ever talk about registers?
When you can refree them? We didn't talk explicitly about it. So the place that's going to be done in our pipeline is in this sort of last commit stage. So when we're doing the absolute final steps of the instruction, when all the instructions before it are finished, we'll figure out what registers we can free based on that. We won't do it earlier because if I've not done instruction A and done instruction B, it's not clear I can free the register from instruction B yet. Or is register that instruction B replaced? Because instruction A might use it. So our next instruction is our move. And so we're moving the value 100 into a register. And something I did not doing here, which is a common point of confusion, is I'm going to move it into R10. What register should I use for that in the renamed version? Answer, anyone? Yeah. 19. So, and what in 19, because that's what R10 currently is, right? So that is a very common answer, and it would be right if this were not a move instruction, right? It's what we wanted to do for add. And it seems like, oh, moves are like adds. And the issue here is that in the move instruction, I'm not writing that I'm moving 100 to a register and then replacing it with another register. So if I were doing that, that would be exactly what I did, right? We're saying X19, and it goes to a new destination register because we always make a new register for a destination. So let's say our destination is X20. So if the move, so if I were converting this like the add, I'd write this sort of move 100, X19 becomes the destination X20. So I could do that, but if we think about what the move doesn't really care what was in R10 previously, and that's what X19 is, right? So we could do this, but it's not useful. It's not what real processors are gonna do, because writing this down here tells me that, oh, I need to have X19, that is the prior value of R10, to run the move instruction. And we don't want to write that down. I also want to make sure that I write to a new value, because there might be some instruction that is above, you know, that uses X19 for something, and it needs to work on the original value of R10, not a new one. Right, it's not using 100 if it's an earlier instruction. It's using some other thing that was in R10. So when I convert this, I'm just going to write that we move 100 into X20, and we actually ignore where the old value of R10 entirely, so we just don't have it in our renamed version, because we don't want to look for X19 when we're actually running this instruction. That makes sense? Yeah.
You might have just said this, but like, how would you see the like evidence if, how would you see register 10's like previous state?
How would I see register 10's previous state? So I knew when we started that register 10 mapped to X19. So there was some code above here that wrote into register 10 and assigned X19 to it. So you're asking, how do we see its previous state? So that's what its previous state was. It's what it has the value that is or is going to be in X19. From some previous instruction we don't know about and we don't actually care about in this part of the processor. And there's this very common confusion I wanted to explicitly go over that, you know, this move instruction, it only writes to that register. We don't care about its prior value. Because very, very commonly, I see people really want to use the prior value or want to overwrite that prior value. We can't overwrite it because there might be some instruction that cares above these instructions. And we always want to write a new register, and we don't need the old value because the move instruction shouldn't be delayed because we haven't computed the previous value yet. Questions, follow-ups? Yeah.
So I guess
I'm not writing X19 in the move is whatever's in X19 might still be needed by the previous instructions? Yes. So that's why I can't just reuse X19. Seeing that it's already assigned to R10. Another way of thinking about it is we said when we did register renaming, we guarantee we write each register once. If a register is in the mapping already, it's already been written to, I can't use it again to write to. But that's another way of saying it, but same idea. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so then I have my subtract. And I subtract from R10, and I'm going to use the new version we just wrote, which is good because we want the subtract to use 100 and not whatever was in there previously. And we're going to subtract into R8, which was X13, and that's going to become a new register, which I'm going to use X21, just going down my list of free registers. You know, I can just keep doing this as long as I don't run out. For the XOR, we use the new R8, and I use the current R9, which is X18, and I write to yet another newly chosen register. And that becomes the new R9 for our last instruction, which is going to be our AND. We're going to use X04, what RAX maps to, and the new R9 we just have, which is X23, and choose yet another value for R9. Register to store R9. So that's register renaming. I mentioned that this is preparation for actually running these instructions. So this is just pre-processing to make it convenient to run. So we're going to go over how they run next. And question first.
So there's basically two ways you do it. If it's add, subtract, XOR, and you do like the same process, but just move is when you like don't change. You know.
So the question is like there are two ways we do it: one for add and subtract, and one for like moves. I'd say they're all examples of the same way. What you need to think about is what are the sources and what are the destinations. And for the adds, we had a source and a source and destination, and that we wrote that as two sources and a destination. For the move, I have a source and a destination. And so that's what I ended up with. And if we go back to the example here, I had kind of a more complicated situation with, say, this move instruction here, where I have a source, at, like this is a source, the register itself, and the memory location is a destination, right? So we just need to think about what really are this instruction sources and destination registers and locations. Yeah? What happens if you run out of free registers? In that case, we're going to stall the pipeline here. And the rest of the pipeline can keep going and hopefully free up those registers for us, but while we're waiting for them, we're just going to not be able to fetch new instructions and all that. So, does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah? For NQ, which one? It's 04, yes. Sorry. I was not being very careful. Yes? How do we know a register is free? So that's going to be done in this sort of end of the pipeline here. And that basically what we're going to do is when all the instructions up to an instruction are finished, this will figure out what registers does that mean will never be used again. And kind of the way we do that is we just say, so for example, here, right, we know that when this instruction runs, R11 is no longer stored in X07. And so every instruction up to and including that instruction I finished, we no longer need X07. Right, so it's going to use that kind of reasoning to figure out when to free up registers. And it's going to do it in order, meaning we're going to wait until every instruction up to a certain one is actually completed. Yes? So the question is the reason to avoid using X19 to avoid signifying dependency. So that's the reason not to have it as a source of the move, right? So the stuff after the arrow, right, is not a dependency, it's what it writes to. So there's another reason we don't want to use it, which is that, X19 has already been written by something else, and we don't want to get confused about what value should be in X19, because remember, we have no way of tracking that there's two different values in a register. All we know is the register has a value or it doesn't, and we'll see that that's the data we'll keep. We'll only keep, is there a value in the register or not? We're not gonna keep which instruction wrote it. Okay, so let's go to our sort of actually running instruction. So let's say we've done a bunch of register renaming, and we're gonna have a list of instructions to run. I'll call the instruction queue, and I'm gonna have information about my registers, and since my registers are written exactly once, since I'm gonna guarantee that in the way I do register renaming, I'm just gonna mark each register as either ready or not ready. And then I'm gonna have a process for finding instructions to run. And I'm gonna have some places to run instructions that we're gonna call execution units. So they kind of correspond to the execute stage, except we'll also call the things that do memory accesses execution units. These are things that can do the actual work of instructions, like adding, subtracting, loading, storing, and so on. And in this example, I have two ALUs that I can run instructions on, which means I can run up to two instructions at a time. And I'm gonna assume my ALUs take one cycle to run each instruction, so my goal is to find every cycle two instructions to run. And how am I gonna do that? Well, I'm gonna go through here, and I'm gonna say, look at each instruction and say, can I run this now? So I look at the first instruction, this instruction number one, and I want to figure out if I can run it. And I see that its sources are X01 and X05. So I look at X01, and I say, oh, that's ready, that's fine to use. And I look at X05, that's ready, that's fine to use. And that means I can run it. So I'm going to assign it somewhere, and I'm gonna put it on, just arbitrarily, I'm gonna put it on ALU1. Then I'm gonna keep searching for instructions that I can run. So I'm gonna look at the second instruction here. It uses X2, which is ready, so that's fine, and X06, that is not ready because it's not listed as ready in my list of things that are ready. So I can't run that right now. Yes. Is there going to be a limit to how far ahead you search? Yes, because this queue obviously is in the hardware. It has a limit on the size. We also could run out of registers when we're renaming and need to stop. We can only fetch so many instructions. So yes, there's going to be a bunch of limits on how far ahead we'll search. So in this example, since we've renamed these nine instructions, we can go at least nine instructions ahead. So in this case, I found out I can't run instruction 2, and let's just keep going. Let's look at instruction 3. I have X3, that is, do this in a different color, X3, that is available. X7, that is not available, so I can't run that one. I have this one which uses X4, that is available. X8, that's not available. Then I have this which uses X9, that is not available, so I can't run that. I have this instruction that uses X1, which is available, but X8 is not. And it turns out that even though I have these nine instructions all ready to run, I can't run another one. I can only find one that I can run, even though I have another slot to put now. And this actually happens a bunch of times with real programs. It's pretty common that when we look at how programs work, that we can't actually do that many things at once because of how the assembly sort of is written. And as a programmer, this is something you can do things about. But this is a reason why we haven't seen processors like, you know, have like 50 ALUs, because you can't actually really use them for most programs. Yeah?
What determines
which determines if the register is ready. So we're going to keep track of which registers have values written into them as instructions run. So for example, since I ran instruction 1 during cycle 1, during cycle 2, in preparation for cycle 2, I'm going to mark X06 as ready because instruction 1 wrote to it. And I'm going to do the similar bookkeeping every time an instruction actually gets run.
Oh, so you're saying it's just because, because in cycle 1 it wasn't ready, but cycle 2
it was. So in cycle 1 it wasn't ready, but in cycle 2 it will be ready because we ran the instruction that set X06.
You also, when you like cross out 6 to make it ready, do you cross out 1 and 5, or cross out 5 to make it like, can't use anymore.
Question, when I cross out 6, do I free up 5?
Not free up,
so they cross out 5. So 5, hypothetically, I guess we're not going to do the processing to figure out there's no instruction that uses 5. Like, I guess in this example, if you say, oh, we finished all the instructions before that, you could say, yes, it's ready, it's free to be reused. There's two reasons we're not going to do that. So one is that in the real scenario, we'll have a lot of instructions in this instruction queue, and there could be other instructions that need 5 that are still in the queue, and we're not going to typically check for that. And also, we're going to do the process of checking over here, which is kind of not where this part of the pipeline is. We're just going to do that later on. And I guess a more subtle reason why we can't just free up 5 right away is we have to worry about things like instruction set faulting or branch mispredictions we don't know about yet. And so that's going to be done later in the pipeline rather than trying to figure all that stuff out here. Okay, so when instruction 1 finishes, I update the list of the scoreboard here, the list of ready registers, to say register X6 is ready. And I do the same analysis I did before, and I find out I can run exactly one instruction now, which is instruction 2. So I'm going to put that on one of my ALUs. I'm going to go through all the other instructions and find out, nope, can't do that, can't do that yet, can't do that yet. And then when instruction 2 finishes, I'm going to mark the place it writes, X7 is ready. And I'll have a similar situation with instruction 3 in cycle 3. So far, we've basically executed the same efficiency as a pipeline processor, actually worse than a pipeline processor, with a lot more complexity. But here we get into a good situation, and that's that after we finish instruction 3, I'm going to do my analysis. And I'm going to say, okay, so this compare here, do we have X4? Yes. Do we have X8? Yes. This jump, do we have X9? No. This add, do I have X1? Yes. Do I have X8? Yes. Finally, we found 2 different instructions we can run. And I have 2 ALUs to run them with. So I'm finally going to run 2 different instructions at once. And you see that we have this like conditional jump, so probably what we're doing is we're running an instruction at the end of the loop at the same time as an instruction at the beginning of the loop. And that's a thing we can do because of branch prediction. You know, we just fetch through the loop as it, guessing the loop would keep going. And so, as is noted here, when I dispatch these instructions, they say, so for the next cycle, now these 2 registers they write to have values available. And I do the same analysis in the next cycle, and I find out, oh, now that means I can run the JNE and this add are now available to run. So I'll dispatch those in cycle 5. And then I find out after those are started, so I've marked 11 as ready, that we can just run the instruction 8 and then instruction 9. So at each step, we're just looking to find as many instructions as we can to run. We have so many slots to put them in, and we'll just eagerly fill those slots. And whether instructions can run, we just look at, is the register ready or not? Is it yes or no? We don't have to do any more complicated checking. And that was kind of the big advantage we had with registry naming, is that really simplified this, what is called instruction dispatch process. Yes? What's the reason why it's .cc? I'll talk about that later. I'm just saying we're looking at a part of the register, basically. But I'll talk about that more explicitly later. Yeah?
Like other programs, do you see unused ALU?
Question, could other programs use the unused ALU if you have multiple things running at once? So if we only have one stream of instructions from a single program, no. But processors work around this by doing what Intel calls hyper-threading, and what is more generically called simultaneous multi-threading, and I guess what AMD probably calls hardware threads, which is basically they make a single core processor appear to the OS as a multi-core processor, and the way that fake multi-core processor works is it runs instructions in this manner from multiple threads at the same time. We're not going to talk about all the details of how that works, but the basic idea is that we just take instructions from two different threads and put them in the same instruction queue, which makes it actually relatively simple to implement. Not super simple because there's still two sets of registers, but relatively simple. Okay. Other questions? Yeah?
How is the scoreboard reset?
So the process of freeing up the registers also needs to update this scoreboard. Yeah, and I'm not going to talk about how that logic works, but yes, it's something we need to, that the processor needs to do, and there's a bunch of bookkeeping like that, which is, I'm not talking about because it's kind of mundane, but obviously your processor doesn't work if it doesn't. Yeah?
So it's like instructions 1 and 2, if the status updating is done in the last stage, then how does instruction 2 know that 6 is pending since it's the
Question, if the status updating is done in the last stage, so I guess I wasn't explicit about what, status updating, okay. So I guess there's two different status things we're kind of worried about. So one is what's on this list of free registers, right? And that's going to be added to in the last stage. But the bookkeeping for this, this list of ready registers, that's going to be done in the stage that does this instruction dispatch. So that's all going to be done in sort of this pipeline stage. And that means that if you think about this all happening in one cycle, this pipeline stage is extremely, has a lot of complicated logic, even though it's not like actually like doing any additions for instructions or anything like that. Yeah. That registry naming is in this, what I have is listed as rename and dispatch. Okay. So rename is registry naming, dispatch is put in the instruction queue. And then, yeah, the name I should give is that we have issue and register read and forward. So issue is choosing what instructions to starting instructions, and we also set up the register reading for them. And also handle the forwarding, which is very much more straightforward because we just check if the register numbers match. To do forwarding. But yes, you may also notice this register file is also doing a lot of work here too. But yeah. This instruction issuing, that's all kind of in this stage here. Okay. And so once we figure out what instructions to run, they go to these, what we call execution units, which I'm using that term. You also might see the term functional units, and these are where the actual work of the instruction is done. And as is shown here, we sometimes are gonna have pipelined execution units. So we'll do pipelining, not just for the whole processor, but for like the addition or the multiplication or something like that. And we also might have sort of things that take multiple cycles to run. in there. So we have a mix of sort of speeds of execution units. And we'll deal with this, so we'll have to deal with the fact that, some of these instructions take different amounts of time once we start them. That's going to be bookkeeping we need to do. Yes?
So do the ALUs also handle, memory reading for the, move instructions?
Do the ALUs handle memory reading for the move instructions? So the execution units do. So I have something labeled load store here. So we'll have, in addition to ALUs, in sort of the same list of things, we'll have, import ports to the data cache. So instead of having E and M separate, they all kind of happen in the same step? Yes. And because we're kind of running the instructions independently, we can actually do the thing where an instruction doesn't have an M step, because they go down kind of separate paths here. So let's do it. Have this. One thing that to help us reason about is that we sometimes have these execution units that take multiple cycles. So let's look at sort of how this works with an example here. So I have a set of instructions, and I'm going to say that I have two ALUs that do most instructions, but I have an ALU for multiplies that takes two cycles, which makes sense. Multiply is pretty complicated. We might not be able to do it in one cycle like we can do adds. And so when I schedule these instructions, I'll look again for instructions I can run, and I find out, register 1 and 2 are ready, register 4 and 5 are ready, and register 3 and 7 are ready, and register 3 is ready, and 8 is not, register 9 is not. And 1 is ready, but 3 is not, and so on. So I'll find out that the instructions I can run are instruction 1, 2, and 3. But I have different types of slots I can put instructions in here, right? And I actually only have one slot that can fit and multiply instructions. So I'm going to end up dispatching 1 and 2. I'm not going to have room to also put 3 in there, because I can put a multiply in the ALU3 slot. I can't put it in the ALU2 slot or the ALU1 slot. So that's the best I can do. And my multiplication is going to take 2 cycles. So I'm going to start it in cycle 1, but it's not going to finish until the end of cycle 2. And I'm going to note that down here. I've just written that down I'm going to start it in cycle 1. It's going to go through this pipeline and actually finish in cycle 2. Yes?
Did you say instruction 3 could be run?
Can I say instruction 3 could be run? So instruction 3 has its values ready, but we don't have a place to put it.
That's it, because it says register 3
is end. Instruction 3, instruction 3 cannot be run. Okay. You're correct. I did not read this carefully. So we couldn't run instruction 3 regardless. Sorry. So, but I put one instruction, that. So I ran that. And then in the next cycle, we're going to update our list of registers that are available. And now, because I finished instruction 1, instruction 3 is ready. Register 3 is ready. But register 6, the thing that the multiply writes to, that is not ready. It's still pending because the multiplies take 2 cycles and we haven't finished yet. And that's fine. We just keep looking for stuff to run. And because now register 3 is ready, and because now I have something I can put in the multiply slot, I can start the multiply for instruction 3, in its first stage, while the second stage of the multiply is finishing. So if we look at our sort of diagram here, right, I have instruction 2 here while instruction 3 is here. Yes?
Did you say if there was a third instruction that could be run and it wasn't multiply? say another add, you picked two because like numerically it's less, or because it took two instructions? Like, how do you decide?
So question is, if I have more instructions I can run than I have slots to put them, how do I decide which ones to prioritize? And that is an arbitrary decision. I think the simplest thing that usually makes the most sense is to pick the first instruction, but you can, probably some processors have, use fancier strategies, or they might do other decisions just because it's easier to implement.
What do you want to do the decision, the instruction that like opens the register that would be used to close index?
What do you want to like base this on, which registers are used by layer instructions? That is a good idea. My suspicion is that most processors don't do something fancy here because it is already difficult to implement this logic quickly. Because if you think about what's happening here, if you have like if your instruction queue has like 32 instructions in it, to figure out what instructions to run, you're doing 32 Boolean lookups in an array in hardware. That's already a lot of work. Or 64 Boolean lookups, 2x, two sources. Okay, so in the next cycle, we find out that we can run instruction 3 and instruction 6. So I dispatch those, and I remember that since I started instruction 3 and this multiplies take two cycles, I'm going to remember it's not going to finish till the next cycle. And then in cycle 3, I can mark the thing the multiply wrote as actually the first multiply did, the one I started way back in cycle 1. Finally, it's available for an instruction to use in cycle 3. And also, we finished instruction 6's operation of writing into x11, so that's ready. And we're going to continue dispatching as we saw before. So we can deal with this sort of instruction issue idea of just checking which they're ready. We can deal with things that don't just take one cycle. We just have to do the bookkeeping to figure out to only mark their values as ready when they actually finish all the steps they need to go through. And it's fine, that's a variable number of steps. And probably the way this actually comes up more often than like a multiply that takes a couple cycles is with like data cache accesses. If there's a cache miss, how do we deal with that? Well, we just don't mark the value as ready until the cache is done. Okay, so questions on this instruction issuing? Yes, Bethel. So the question is, do we do forwarding here between the ALU stages? So we can't do forwarding like, I should use a different color. We can't do like this. That doesn't work because the value's not ready yet, right? If we have two parts, it's not ready for the second part. So as for like this type of forwarding, yes, I'm assuming we're actually doing that. In order to have the timing work as it does, we have to actually do that sort of forwarding. So not kind of shown explicitly on this picture is we probably actually have like some sort of connections to enable forwarding made over here. Does that answer your question? And like I didn't show it explicitly because you can think about it just as saying, if the ALU takes one cycle, how do we have the value available in the next cycle? The answer is actually we're forwarding it. But I just didn't show that explicitly because I think it's, if you think of it that way, you just don't need to think of how that is actually implemented. Yeah?
So I remember you said the way we determine whether the instruction can be finished within one cycle is depending on some data cache misses. But don't we need to know whether it can be finished within one cycle to assign it to the appropriate ALU like before it's even executed?
So the question is, don't we need to know how long the instruction will take to finish to assign it to the appropriate unit? So what's going to happen is that we're going to have some mapping between the type of instruction and which of the sort of slots it can go in here. So like I have four slots here, right? And some instructions can only go in the load store slot. Some instructions can go in any of the ALU slots. Some instructions can only go in the last ALU slot. And we'll just have some table in the issue that lets us know that. And for things like load stores that like might take a variable amount of time, we won't set the thing as set the register as ready until we get a signal back from the load store unit telling us, yes, it's ready now. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah. Do the memory accesses from moves also happen in the ALU cycle? So they'll typically have a separate type of execution unit. So if I was adding them to my picture here, like I'd have another line, which is like load store, with another place I could put instructions. Does that answer your question? And I guess, and on the homework, we have that idea. We have a load, no, I guess we don't have that. But on the homework, I think we might do that. We have something similar to this, right? Where we have different types of instructions go in different slots, and we just have to figure out what type of instructions they take. We'll typically have, yeah, something other than ALU that takes moves from memory or to memory. Okay. Other questions? Okay, and I promised earlier I'd talk about the sort of .cc idea. And that's like, there's one thing that we kind of skipped over in registry naming that's kind of important if we actually want to run like x86 code. And that's that, well, you know, let's say we have an instruction that uses the stack pointer, right? Like a pop instruction. We actually have to remember that the stack pointer is an input to the instruction to know when we can run it. We can't run it if the value of the stack pointer is not computed yet. And we also have to use different registers for different versions of the stack pointer if we're following the registry naming idea. And also, we have things like condition codes. We want to make sure our jump waits for the condition codes to be available. So one way, not the only way of dealing with this, but one way we can deal with this is we can take instructions that use the stack pointer but don't write RSP as a parameter and just add RSP as a parameter when we do registry naming. And this is sort of a thing, a common strategy that x86 processors use, and not just like to add the stack pointer as a parameter when it's not already, but also to handle sort of complicated instructions. So like a pop instruction is actually pretty annoying if we look at what I showed you there, because it does an ALU operation and a load and store, and a load. And that seems to require two different ALUs. And one way of implementing this is when we do registry naming, we also convert instructions like pop or instructions like add to a memory location to, or instructions like to use multiple instructions. And we can also add as an explicit parameter things like setting condition codes. You know, we can make them have a named register instead of being kind of implicit, because that's more convenient for this out of order design. So questions about this idea of sort of converting instructions to more convenient forms when we do registry naming? Yeah. Are there other forms of like pipeline-based optimization? You mean like this type of stuff? Yes. So this is one of the things like Intel prides themselves on doing. They would say, well, yeah. So you and I guess another form of this that is common is that sometimes the instructions will do processors will do what something called they call it usually called like instruction fusion, where they'll take two instructions and convert them to one and renaming two. So we'll go the other way. Other questions? So that's sort of my brief, sort of high-level overview of out-of-order processors. We kind of went into sort of how we actually issue instructions. We kind of skipped over a bunch of the bookkeeping for what if we need to undo instructions, how do we free up registers. And we're going to talk about some of the consequences of this, but as far as like how good is this, like one thing I tried to make kind of clear here is that there's some limitations to this technique, which is why it hasn't just magically made all our processors, you know, infinitely fast. And a big one is that we can't always find instructions to run in this. We saw that it's pretty easy to have a kind of a realistic looking set of instructions, and we look for stuff to do, and we have 10 instructions, we can't do any of them. And this happens in real programs. So even though many sort of desktop and laptop processors today can issue 5 instructions per cycle, or sometimes more, but sometimes 5 or 6 instructions per cycle, you're very unlikely to have run any programs that actually run 5 or 6 instructions per cycle. Just because there's not going to be the work to do when they look for things to do. There's going to be too many things that we need to wait for before we can do anything else. Also, we need to track sort of all the instructions that are around. We need to track all the different versions of values that we aren't finished with yet. And processors use a lot of space for this, but they only get you so far ahead. So for example, on Skylake, which is Intel's processor from 2017-ish design, uses a 224 entry reorder buffer, which stores kind of pending instructions that haven't been cleaned up yet. So it's the storage for doing things like freeing up the registers. That only has 224 entries, so you can only go 224 instructions ahead, which is a lot, but it's not even close to infinite, and that's a lot of space on the processor to do that already. And they have 168 registers, physical registers, which is, again, a lot, but it's not infinite. That's kind of limits how many instructions you could actually go ahead. And to do that already, you have this huge register file, and if we're running 5 instructions per cycle that you need to read like 10 times every cycle, that's already a lot of work, a lot of space in the processor to do that. And another thing which happens is that these processors use fancy branch prediction I mentioned when we talk about branch prediction. And a big reason for that is that doing all this stuff of running multiple instructions at once and having more complicated bookkeeping means that branch mispredictions are way more costly. With our pipeline processor, we were like losing like 2 instructions worth of work when we had a branch misprediction. With a processor with the out-of-order design, sometimes we'll lose 16 cycles of work, which is like 80-ish instructions of work if we think we can do 4 instructions per cycle from a branch misprediction. Because there's so much more bookkeeping to do in that case. So questions about these limits are pipeline processors. Okay. So one thing that we finally answered is, when we started the class, I had this example of 2 loops that took the same amount of time. We now know why. What's happening is that these 2 ads here can run in the same amount of time that that one ad takes, but we have to run each ad after the other. So that's why these took the same amount of time to run, even though we had more instructions, because of that out-of-order design. When we were dispatching instructions, in the second loop we can dispatch 2 at a time, in the first we can only dispatch 1. You know, so you're wasting space. We had available ALUs in the processor we weren't using. That's where we got more efficiency out of the second loop as far as number of instructions there. Okay, so we talked about sort of the good things about out-of-order processors running programs fast, and maybe not as fast as we'd like, but faster. Our kind of last unit, and also the topic of the lab, is going to be about some unfortunate things about out-of-order processors and security. And we're going to introduce it with what the topic of the lab tomorrow, which is going to be talking about side channels. And we'll look at side channels that apply to out-of-order processors specifically on Thursday. But first, I'm going to talk about the scenario that's in the lab. And in the lab, we have this check passphrase function. And it has this oopsie, which is that it compares character by character. Nice way to compare passphrases. But that means that the number of iterations of that while loop is equal to the number of matching characters. And what you're going to do in the lab is you're going to say, well, if you measure how long it takes to do a bunch of different passphrases, you'll find that the ones which do more iterations of the while loop, meaning more characters match, take longer. So we can look at this data and say, gosh, probably starts with a D. And then we can say, okay, huh, let's try D in a bunch of things. Huh, probably starts with a DF. And so this notion is called something called a timing side channel attack. So the name side channel is because the output of our check passphrase operation isn't supposed to be this time. It's supposed to be the yes or no. But that's not the signal we're using. We have this side signal, this unintentional signal we're getting out, which is telling us actually how many things match, even though that's not what's being returned here. So in the lab, you're going to write a program that guesses passphrases using this principle. And we're going to talk about some other implications of this side channel problem, that when we write sort of natural programs, we often end up leaking information kind of on the side that we didn't intend to leak. And this is a problem that we'll learn out-of-order processors make a lot worse. Questions? Yeah, yes?
So, because it's looping through every character, so like due to, I guess, like speculative and like caching, would the processor not like do optimizations that make timing weird, or because it's very pattern based, it would still like have the overall pattern?
So the question is, doesn't the timing for this function get sort of messed up by the speculative execution, things like that? Yes. That it's still going to be strong enough to get a signal. What we'll learn, and why I'm saying out-of-order processors make this problem worse, is that out-of-order processors are going to create these side channels in cases where they wouldn't otherwise exist, which is going to be overall worse, even though, yes, they kind of make it actually harder to exploit this. Also, you'll learn in the lab that even though it makes it harder, you'll still be able to do it. Like, it's not going to make it too hard. You'll run on the lab machines, and you can write a program that does this consistently enough, even with all the out-of-order execution and branch prediction going on. And so this sort of passphrase checking is kind of a toy example, though one people have gotten in real trouble for doing. Like, if you have a security-sensitive application and your compare function looks like this, there have been programs which have actually been exploited this way. But probably the place where this problem was discovered was with cryptography. And in cryptography, when we're implementing especially things like asymmetric encryption or digital signatures, there's a lot of big integer math. And let's say we want to do some big integer math, like I want to multiply two 500-bit numbers together. I can't just use the multiply instruction because the multiply instruction multiplies 64-bit numbers. How do I multiply 500-bit numbers? And let me give an algorithm. Since this isn't a class of knowing how to write multiply algorithms, but a way I can multiply, say, to 64-bit integers to get 128-bit integer, I can do this without a 64-bit multiply by using smaller multiplies. So what I'll do is I'll divide x into two parts and y into two parts. Right, I'll have the zeros place and the 2 to the 32 place. So I've just taken a 64-bit number, divided that into two 32-bit parts, and then the way multiplying these two things together, if I do a little algebra, I find out that I can multiply x and y together, and I get this expression just by doing algebra of how I multiply polynomials. And so I can do, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 multiplies to implement my bigger multiply. And I'm showing this example using a 32-bit multiply operation to do a 64-bit multiply, 64 to 128-bit multiply. We can extend this idea to multiply arbitrarily large numbers, and this is probably the most obvious way to implement that idea of let's multiply two 500-bit numbers together, which is the sort of operation many sort of asymmetric cryptography would want to do. And so, if I'm implementing multiply for asymmetric cryptography, I'm going to divide my number up into fixed size pieces and have a loop where I get this sort of individual multiplications for each of those pieces. Great, I've implemented multiply. And the problem is that that algorithm has the same issue I had with my check passphrase function. How many steps the loop takes depends on the size of the numbers involved. And that's really bad for cryptography, because just like with passphrases, we don't want to know how many characters match. With cryptography, we don't want to know how big the intermediate numbers are. That's not information we're supposed to know. Yeah. Couldn't you scale everything up to the highest size? Absolutely, and that is going to be probably the main mitigation of this. Of course, that means you need to figure out the highest size in advance. Right, which means that if you have a general sort of big integer library, it probably doesn't do that. Other questions? And this, in fact, was kind of where sort of timing attacks, these sort of timing side channels got the attention of academia. So there's a paper from 2003 called Remote Timing Attacks Are Practical, where they showed that early versions of OpenSSL, a very commonly used TLS implementation, had this attack in their cryptography operations, and that you could not just figure out information about those numbers, you could turn that into parts of the private key. And it was because of variable time multiplication and modulus operations. And they were variable time because of this sort of strategy that we were doing, you know, them as simpler, small operations that depended on the exact numbers involved. And in particular, kind of a big problem was there internally was an operation where they basically like subtracted two values and then used the result. So knowing how big that subtracted value, you know, result of subtraction was really useful for finding out things about the private key. And sort of they showed in the paper that, you know, they have bits guessed of something, and basically the timing told you how close you were because there was a subtraction that got closer to zero the closer your answer was. So I've showed you these sort of timing attacks, and there's some other types of side channels that are out there. I want us to think more broadly about ways in which unintended information leaks out. And one example of this that comes up a lot is in web browsers. So web browsers, they're running code from a website that you don't really trust, and they want to keep data secret from those websites and the code they're running. And one example of data that should be kept secret is what other websites you have visited. You don't want to go to someone's website and have them figure out all the other sites you visited. That's not supposed to happen. And there used to be a problem where web browsers actually leaked this information, which was kind of not a consequence of like forgetting to think about timing, but sort of an unintended consequence of two very deliberate features. So one of these features is something that you'll still see, which is that if you click on a link, sometimes the link is styled differently to show you visited it already. It's a useful feature. Very intentional, good idea. And there's another useful feature, which is that if you're writing scripts for websites, sometimes it's useful to know how some part of the website is styled so you can adjust how it looks. But the combination of these two features is pretty bad because it leaks exactly which websites you visited. You just make a web page with links to a million websites. You write some script code that checks the colors of all those links, and now you know someone's visited each of 1 million websites. And the web browser solution to this is that they got rid of the feature number two. And feature number two just lies about the color. It just says it's always the unvisited color. And also they restrict what styling you can do for visited links to prevent some other ways of inferring this information. And more recently, there's been other things people have thought about as far as web browsers leaking things. And this is with timing. That we can run like code on a website, right? It's not just displaying something. We can have like code running. And that code can look at how long things take. And how long things take depends on what else is running on your machine. Examples of other things running on your machine include like tabs for other websites. And people have found out that, it turns out that you get kind of different timing. If you just record the time for doing something over and over again, you kind of get different signatures depending on what's going on in the other tab. And you could like match that to popular websites. You have another kind of unintended information leak here. Yeah.
Would you be able to use
something like this to figure out what's in the cache? That is exactly what we'll talk about next. I will say, the primary way web browsers try to mitigate this against this is getting a high-resolution timer in JavaScript is actually very hard in a web browser. And that is very deliberate. Yeah, so I guess in our last 2 minutes, we'll go to what's going to be our sort of big case for these side channels. So we talked there's a whole bunch of types of information that kind of get accidentally leaked. And a lot of it's based on just how long things take. That how long things take depends on things that we aren't supposed to know, like how many digits of something match and so on, or what else is going on in other tabs. And as asked, this is a big thing where how long things take leaks information is the cache. So if I have an array of cares and I time how long it takes to read a bunch of things from that array, and one of them takes a lot longer than the other, a good guess is that means that something that goes to the same set of the cache as, in this case, array of 192, evicted the array earlier. So presumably, if I read everything else was in the cache, so I've learned something about what was in the cache. I learned that everything but array of 192 was in the cache. That means something else must have evicted array of 192 or it was never loaded. One of those two things. And we can use this to figure out what's accessed by code that we don't have access to. So if I can run code before and after this mystery access to other address in this example, I can fill the cache with an array of my choice. Then I can check the whole array and see is what parts of it seem to still be in cache by timing how long it takes to access each part. And I would guess that exactly one part will be slow, and that was what was evicted. And that will tell me something about the address that was accessed. It won't tell me all of the address, but it tells me what the set of the address that was accessed is. And I guess I didn't ask, well, the question, because we're out of time, but I should have. So the address, I guess, what do we know? We have actually heard it. So he thinks we know it's going to be the same tack. I think it's definitely going to be a different tack. Okay. So we have that, and I would agree. Who thinks it's going to be the same index? I think it's definitely going to be a different index. So it's going to be the same index. Is that would be correct? Because it wasn't, because we know it made the other thing slower. The other thing was evicted. I think it's going to be the same offset, different offset. And the answer here is it could be either. We don't know. So both could be right. And we're gonna extend on this next time. We're gonna see that this problem combined with branch prediction is gonna get us in a lot of trouble.